There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you can join us here for another classic cardboard conversation. Although this cardboard is less cardboard and all bathed in UV coating, baby. That damned UV coating from the early 1990s. Boy, if we only knew then the conditioning issues that UV coating would do to cards, we would have never have done it. Plus, the smell gives me a headache. But anyways, we've got an interesting set. Have you ever gone to a card shop or maybe cruising around eBay like I did, and you're looking for one thing, but then something else pops up? And when you see it, you go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, baby. And it's not just because, you know, it's a pretty good card or a pretty good pack or a pretty good set, but you can get it for a pretty good price. And as is often the case with collecting cards, it brings back great memories. The nostalgia comes flooding back, and you realize for mere pennies on the dollar, you are going to enjoy this nostalgia. That was the case for me and our main focus on this show. 1993 Upper Deck, we've got Series 1 foil jumbo packs. And I know Series 2 is the one everybody wants because that's where the Derek Jeter rookie card is. But I was on eBay probably about 3 weeks ago. And thanks to your donations, we've had a couple of very friendly cash donations and even small ones, too. You know, we're talking $10, $15 donations. And because those small donations add up after a little while, I was able to go shopping. I was actually kind of in danger of not having, you know, some kind of topic of conversation to discuss this week, a few weeks ago. But I went shopping, and I'll detail all the other things that I bought. We are certainly set for show topics over the next 2 or 3 months. But I was looking for some 94 Donruss, 95 Elite. Let's see, what else was I looking at? 93, 94, 95, Ultra. You know, just kind of dabbling a little bit, per listener suggestions, dabbling a little bit in some of the cards that I'd forgotten I collected. You know, I did have some 94 Donruss, not many, and I got rid of them pretty quickly. I think I only bought a couple packs back in the day. I actually, when it came to new sports cards, I was buying more hockey cards in 94, 95. And despite the fact that hockey was also experiencing a work stoppage, the National Hockey League didn't start their season until January of 1995, I think I was just more disgusted at Major League Baseball's screwing up everything in the 1994 season, that I would somehow tolerate the work stoppage in hockey and collect more hockey cards. I also suddenly became more interested in the NBA. That was, along with the NFL, that was the only professional sports league going on at the time. But as I'm looking around for, you know, some of these kind of 93, 94, 95, like I said, Donruss and Fleer and you know, some sets that perhaps I hadn't bought, as I'm scrolling through the searches, one thing pops up on my eBay search. And there it is, shining gold, 93 Upper Deck Series 1 Jumbo Packs. And they were in an auction mode. Normally I just do the buy it now or make an offer, but they were in the auction mode. And, you know, I put in a high bid of like $6 or something. Somehow, was outbid once. I'm suspecting it was probably the seller. But anyways, I brought up the bid a couple dollars and won it. So for a grand total of like, I don't know, $9 including shipping, I got both of these jumbo packs. And when they came in the mail, it was, again, just the nostalgia rushing over me. As 1993, and I've discussed this before, especially when we were talking about Topps base set from 93 a few months ago. You know, 1993 was a big year for me in my fandom in baseball, as you know, being a sports fan, also, you know, kind of starting to chart the course of my life and career. You know, that's when I started really expressing an interest in doing broadcasting, and when I was in high school, video production, stuff like that. And of course, I've got a lot of great memories from 1993, as I've discussed before. And they always come back with, you know, a pack of Topps cards from 93, perhaps a pack of Stadium Club cards. Donruss, too, they had a pretty good set in 93. I might go looking for some of those. And, you know, all this nostalgia around some of the other really awesome sets, like Fleer Ultra, Leaf Studio, you kind of forget about Upper Deck in 1993, or at least I do. And if you do overlook Upper Deck from 1993, you need to pull yourself back and take a second look at it. Because, my God, 93 Upper Deck, this was, I don't want to say pinnacle, because that was Scores premium brand. This was the apex, I believe, in Upper Deck's release, in terms of design, especially impact on the hobby, and really, it was, I think it was kind of that last Upper Deck set, the style that we all know and love before things got out of hand in the hobby over the next several years and the oversaturation. And just opening up these packs, I was reminded of it. I mean, the photography is incredible. The quality of cards is great. A few sorting issues. If you watched our pack break that was posted yesterday on YouTube, and if you didn't see the link in our Wax and Gumstains Twitter timeline, just go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1993 Upper Deck Jumbo Pack Break. You'll see that there's a couple of dupes within the packs. And, you know, that was something that tended to happen. And part of the reason why was the 1993 Upper Deck set was a monstrous 840 cards split up over two series. So you suddenly had 420 cards, as opposed to the typical 700 card base set plus 100 card update set that was tacked on later in the year. So you had, you know, some sequencing issues. If you got a good card twice in the pack, well, lucky you. Me, I believe it was Marquise Grissom and Roger McDowell. No offense to those guys. In fact, we'll be talking about Roger McDowell later on in the program. But, you know, that's not exactly Pedro Martinez. Did get a Pedro Martinez, but with the dreaded UV specs on it, because those cards tend to stick together. But still, despite the faults there, and of course realizing even if I were to, you know, try to sell that Pedro Martinez or the Ozzie Smith that I pulled out of there, I might get, you know, might be able to do it for a quarter. Still just these great memories, because Upper Deck was still, even though it was fierce, facing some fierce competition in terms of premium style cards, Upper Deck was still the high bar. And even though Topps had a great set, I said Donruss had a pretty good set in 93. You had the awesome Ultra. Stadium Club was pretty decent. You know, Leaf Studio, like I said. You had all of these options here, but Upper Deck was still the one that you kind of went to if you were looking for the top base set that was released back then. And I remember buying those jumbo packs and ripping them open, hoping that I didn't drop them, as I mentioned in the video. The packs, because there was a little bit of room for the product to move in the foil pack, if you had the misfortune of, you know, dropping it, or if it was handled in a box that wasn't handled properly by the store clerk stocking the shelves, you often ended up with some dinged cards coming out of it. But despite those flaws, you went to it, and it was an awesome, awesome set. And considering what Upper Deck had produced over the previous years and how they fended off, for the most part, the competition, I always loved the effort that they put into the 93 set. And because I stopped collecting new cards in 1994 and didn't collect a new card, you know, didn't buy a new card pack for a good 10 years afterwards, you know, I kind of remember 93 Upper Deck is you know, being it. You know, the great set that came about in 1989 that continued to reinvent itself kind of slowly through the following three or four sets. And then 1993, it just really came up with a great set. But there were some flaws, too. And not just, you know, somebody jamming the box of cards onto a shelf type flaws. But we'll discuss them. There were some things that were indicative of what was to come in the hobby, where it did get out of hand. And it was also a sign, kind of ironic, a sign of how Upper Deck became a victim of its own success, not just because the competition was, you know, bearing down on them a little bit harder, and not just because the market was becoming flooded with more and more Upper Deck-like cards that were being featured not only in base sets, but various premium sets and subsets, I should add, but also because of the financial calamity that Upper Deck found itself when one of its co-founders, Dwayne Bice, sued the company and raked in a lot of cash over the years while the hobby, the floor was about to fall out from underneath Upper Deck and everybody else. So there's a lot of great memories, not only because of just, you know, my personal life and experience in buying Upper Deck back then, but also it is kind of a watermark point, not only for Upper Deck, but as we've discussed before, in the hobby. There's kind of a crossing point between 1993 and 1994 where things started going downhill, and ultimately everything kind of got washed out, and you ended up with the exclusivity deal that Major League Baseball and the Players Association now has with Topps, which has been in effect since 2005. So we'll look back at the 93 Upper Deck set in just a little bit. But first, want to remind you that our Twitter timeline, Wax and Gum Stains, is open 24/7. And we are always taking comments there. A lot of people enjoying our last podcast featuring 75 Topps. Zach Byrne talking about Mike Hegan. He was one of the 9 players that we were talking about from that pack of 75 Topps. And Zach says, thank you for discussing Mike Hegan's post-playing career. Hegan's indoor batting cage was a staple of my younger years. I participated in many winter hitting leagues and even hosted my birthday party there. I also once met Sal Bando there. Well, I only hope that Sal Bando had that awesome Oakland A's mustache at the same time. Hopefully he hadn't shaved it by the time you were having your birthday party at the Mike Hegan Batting Center. Now, we also were pulled into a conversation about the print runs of 75 Topps. And I want to clarify something that I said. You know, have you ever said something where you're thinking one thing and it kind of comes out the other? I had said in the podcast that 75 Topps had a lot of double prints in the higher numbers. And that is a little inaccurate, because there's technically no double print in the higher numbers. Of course, 1975 Topps released in one series, so it's not like previous series where you would have short prints in the higher series because Topps just printed fewer of them, but you would have double prints of some cards based on just the layout of the cards on the sheets and how they were divvied up inside the packs. No, what actually happened, and this is how I misstated it, what happened was, with 75 Topps being a 660-card set, and that would allow Topps the opportunity to print the cards in, 110-card sheets. So six 110-card sheets. So you had the equal cutting of the cards here. But for whatever reason, in 75, the first sheets that were printed, so cards 1 through 110, for whatever reason, they printed fewer of those cards. It doesn't make much sense. But there is, if you go buying large lots of cards, you will notice more of the higher number cards appearing in some of these lots. And it's not a widespread phenomenon. I can tell you, though, I've experienced it myself in buying lots of 75 cards, especially over the last few months, just trying to build up my 75 top set. And I have noticed in especially those high-end numbers, quite a few duplicate cards in some of these collections. And we're not just talking like two or three of these cards. I'm talking, and you know, I'm not making this number up, six, seven, eight cards of, you know, common players, typically in the 400 and 500 and 600 range there. So I was a little inaccurate in how I was describing that. There are no double prints in the high numbers, but there is the appearance of double prints. There's the impression of double prints thanks to the inexplicable low print run of that first sheet of cards. Now, I don't know if that was just part of the budget conscious money saving operation that Topps was running in 1975. As we discussed, they were challenged with a lot of economic issues in the mid 70s. That's why they went to one series. That's why they experimented with the mini set. That's why, you know, they were, you know, reducing the thickness of the cardstock as well. And even though the 75 Topps design is quite memorable because of the explosion of color that's on those cards, it was also just simple. It was easy to design. And it was basically just a patchwork of a whole lot of color squares. That was basically it. So when you look at 75 Topps, again, to clarify, there are no double prints because there was an equal, even number amount of cards on each sheet that Topps printed up. But for some reason, sheet number one, those first 100 or so cards from the set, were for some reason printed in slightly fewer quantities. So if you do come across large lots of cards, and I'm talking, you know, 300-400 cards, you will notice a heavier amount of cards in the higher series. And like I said, I've pulled some lots where there's six or seven or eight cards of one guy. And that's why you get that impression of, oops, I somehow got a DP here. Well, that's not the case. So again, just to clarify, no double prints, just a shorter run on the first sheet for whatever reason. And I do thank people for commenting on that. Wanted to make it perfectly clear. You know, I wasn't trying to mislead anybody there. It clearly just came out of my mouth the wrong way. And sometimes that's what happens. Now, what also happens is your donations helping out this program. As I mentioned, we've had a few people drop in $5 or $10 here or there over the last several weeks. And I was able to collect all those and go shopping. If you would like to make a donation, you can do so at our PayPal website. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. It's not really a website. That's more just our direct page there. So paypal.me/waxecstatic is where you can send a cash donation. And again, even small donations, $5, $10 goes a long way with this show. And I do know that the economy is tough. It's only going to get tougher. So we do also accept cardboard donations. If you wanted to make a cardboard donation, and by that I mean send me a lot of cards, send me a couple packs or something, or maybe you've got a couple of extra cards that have always entertained you and you would think would be interesting to discuss on the show, then you can do so. Just email me, mattsammonsays@gmail.com. That's mattsammonsays@gmail.com. And let me know what you would like to send before you send it, so I know what's coming. And there are no surprises. Nobody is a big fan of surprises when you get packages just showing up on your doorstep. But going back to the cash donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic, like I said, we were able to pull together a lot of the donations and go shopping. And those cash donations help us not only keep the podcast running strong on our Audio Boom home base, but also through all the channels that we send the program to. But it also allows us to keep the archives free. We don't have to charge if you want to listen to some of the older programs. And like I said, we were able to get some product here, and we've got some great stuff here. So in no particular order, here's what we're going to be talking about over the next few months. First, the two sets that I have been talking about recently. Yes, we will give our honor to the disastrous and not well-liked 1982 Topps Kmart 20th Anniversary MVP set. Sometime later this summer, we will do that. Also, as promised in the previous show, we will take a second look at 1961 Topps. A lot of talks about aesthetics and who cares about aesthetics. Look at that set. And we'll take another look at it since I do have a few more cards in the collection than one I had when we did our first show on it back in 2017. And thanks to your donations, we were able to add not only the 93 Upper Deck Jumbos that we recently purchased, but we also have some 1986 Donruss packs to open up. I loved 86 Donruss. And that is one of those sets that if you can get unopened packs or even an unopened box, you can get them affordably. And it's a pretty fun set to collect and very, very representative of 1986. I've always called it the Max Headroom set because of the kind of squiggly vertical hold background that you see. It is very MTV, New Coke, It Screams 1986. And it's also one of the better sets from 1986. We did a show recently on 86 Topps, and 86 Topps is a great set. I'm almost completing that set thanks to a couple of kind donations from our listeners. And yeah, it's a popular set, even though it's not, you know, design-wise up there with some of the best that Topps put out. But I think if you look at the other two big competitors, Donruss and Fleer, they put out some awesome sets in 86. And I say big competitors because Sports Flicks was in the market in 1986, but would soon be bowing out just because the price point of those cards were a little too high. And they were, you know, a little kitschy for some people. They didn't like the motion graphics thing. It wasn't, you know, the thing that really lured collectors or even kids into buying those cards. But 86 Donruss, we will look at that in an upcoming show. I also purchased some 1993 minor league baseball cards. These are the classic best baseball cards. This is when minor league cards started getting out of hand. And, you know, minor league cards date back to the mid-1970s. They kind of got popular the second time around in the late 80s and early 90s as people were on the rookie card craze and they decided that, you know, what's better than an 89 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. card. Well, let me find an 87 or an 88 Pro Cards Ken Griffey Jr. with the Bellingham Mariners. And all of a sudden, there was this new round of rookie cards. People were snatching up, you know, 1980s minor league cards of Cal Ripken and Don Mattingly and Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire and all the big names that there was a minor league set. People were tracking him down. And of course, minor league sets were pretty much just, you know, released in that minor league town or maybe in that region. And, you know, there was some scarcity to it. So I remember, you know, some minor league cards from those 1980s sets, early 80s typically, were selling for top dollar because there was scarcity. And of course, if you're a six-year-old kid getting a pack of baseball cards at a minor league stadium, you know, and you know, Dubuque, Iowa or whatever, yeah, you know, you're not going to take care of those cards. No, you're going to, you know, stick them in a shoebox and put the rubber bands around them and everything else. So, you know, there was some value there, but by 1993, that started careening out of control. So we'll take a look back at those cards. Also picked up, what else did I get here? Oh, a couple of, dare I say, novelty items, but I think these will be fun to look at. We picked up two items that I think are going to reflect well on just some of the quirky things that were coming out in not only the mid-80s, but also in the late 70s. So we're going to combine these two products that I purchased for a look at just some of the unique all-star items that were being produced back in that time. And what they are, we've got the 1987 Donruss All-Star Pop-Up cards. Do you remember those? These were all-star cards that had kind of a pop-up look to them. You assembled them to where the player, be it a batter, in the batter's box or a pitcher on the mound, would stand out, almost like those 3D books that you used to play with as a kid. And it would have the Houston Astrodome, the interior of the Astrodome, as a backdrop. And they were kind of neat. I remember I had one as a kid. I think it was Cal Ripken, I think, was the player that I had. And I thought it was kind of a unique way of showing off all-star cards, rather than just having just waxy, glossy inserts like Topps would do. Donruss was trying to do something pretty unique. And it also kind of falls into that kid-centric big card, the Topps big cards at the time, Donruss having, big cards in the earlier 80s. So it's a very unique set. So I picked up a few of those packs and we'll open those up and see who the players are. But then I also had a very unique product that I found. These were Topps chewing gum wrappers of all-star players. So if you remember as a kid, and they still sell Bazooka Joe bubblegum, it's harder to find than it used to be. But if you remember as a kid, you would get that box of Bazooka Joe bubblegum, and you would open up the little pieces, and there was a Bazooka Joe comic inside. Well, what Topps did was they took the Bazooka Joe bubblegum and, just called it Topps chewing gum, and wrapped the pieces of gum in these cartoon wrappers of all-star players. So this is not all that different with Topps experimenting with their gum product in the late 70s with the jumbo packs. Remember, we did a look at the 81 Topps super packs, where they had basically the cello pack on top, and then in a separate package on the bottom, they had a few pieces of gum there. So Topps was trying to push the gum product in the late 70s, and they decided to tie it in with these all-star wrappers. And that's going to be fun to look at because it's an incredibly ingenious idea, clever marketing piece. But for some reason, it didn't fly. It only lasted 1 year. And I'm curious as to why that is. And we'll take a look. We're going to open up a few pieces of this gum. I'm not going to eat it. Well, maybe. We'll see how I'm feeling that day. But we'll take a look at some of these wrappers and muse a little bit as to why such a unique item just did not work for whatever reason. So those are some of the upcoming programs. Again, 61 Topps we'll do a second look at. We've got the Topps Kmart 82 MVP set, the very unpopular set, but something that does need to be looked at as it does play a pivotal part in our hobby history. And we'll also look at, as promised, 86 Donruss, the 93 Classic Best Minor League cards, and also the combo of 87 Donruss All-Star Pop-Ups and 1979 Topps Chewing Gum All-Star Wrappers. And last but not least, something I will continue to preach until the coronavirus is under control and we are back to some sense of normalcy where we are not shouting at each other via our various political spectrums. But as the coronavirus continues to go through, if not a second wave, then a rather steady wave, and it still affects everything that we are doing in this country and around the world too. It's not just us, but boy, we're really bad at this, aren't we? Yep, we really are. And it's a crying shame. It really is. So until the coronavirus, we've got a grip on it, or there is some workable vaccine that is out there to try to control it a little bit. As always, wash your hands, wear a mask, and practice social distancing if possible. And be considerate not only of your neighbor, but if you're just a selfish bastard, think of it as trying to take care of yourself. Because as I like to say, there are a lot of people that are screaming about their rights being infringed because they have to wear a mask or they have to social distance. The option to having your rights, quote unquote, infringed is death. So if you don't want to die, if you don't want your family members to die, then wash your hands, wear a mask, and continue practicing social distancing. Thank you. All right, let's take a look back at the 1993 Upper Deck set. As I was saying before, a monstrous set. It was the largest set to date for Upper Deck, and it would be a size that the Upper Deck base set would use for many, many years. 840 cards split over two sets, or two series, I should say. 420 cards each series, and there was one big reason why the Upper Deck set grew so much in 1993. That, of course, the expansion, the addition of the Florida Marlins and Colorado Rockies. Those players would show up in rather copious amounts in Series 2. But also, as Upper Deck would dive into more and more of the inserts and the subsets, there were some special inserts, which we'll get to, which, again, is also a sign of just the direction the hobby was going in at that time. But Upper Deck tried to wedge in a lot more inserts. So you had your top rookies. You had another subset called Community Heroes. And they really just tried to jam in a few more things into the regular set that had grown, like I said, from 700 with the base set and the 100 cards for the update set to a massive 840 cards over two series in 1993. Now, the design of 1993 Upper Deck is an absolute classic. And what else would you expect from Upper Deck, right? Mainly focusing on photography, great color photography, great action shots too, but also some lighthearted and whimsical shots. And we'll discuss one of them, one of the player cards we have. It's just kind of one of those off-the-cuff shots here that one of the Upper Deck photographers got. And that's what made Upper Deck so fun, too. Yes, you paid more for it. Yes, it was a glossy premium base set. But you had a lot of unique camera angles. You had a lot of unique shots, spur-of-the-moment players in their natural setting kind of things, and some really goofy pictures as well. But the action shots were great. They were crystal clear. The pictures on the backs of the cards were large, full color. Even the more mundane shots, like a guy sitting in the dugout, it actually looked pretty solid. And as we went through the two packs that we opened up a few days ago, you could see, you know, the colors popping out here. You know, for example, Ed Taubensee, who was with the Houston Astros, wearing the Astro Road uniform at that time, of course, the cream color with the rainbow shoulder stripes, and the colors just pop like crazy on this card here. And the photography, of course, was just incredible. And, you know, Upper Deck would play around a little bit, had some, you know, multi-image shots. There's one of Andre Dawson with the Cubs. Of course, he would be playing with the Marlins in 1993. But Dawson is, you know, tracking down a fly ball and catching it while tumbling to the ground at Wrigley Field near the bullpen. And it actually looks like he's fallen and he can't get up, which, you know, Andre Dawson's knees by 1992-93 may have been in that situation. But, you know, the multiple exposure cards, the multiple exposure pictures that Upper Deck used a lot starting around 1991, you would see that appear again throughout the 1993 set. And, you know, just some really interesting photography and classic stuff here, just some awesome shots. And that is something that is certainly a hallmark of Upper Deck throughout their early years. But just something about the 93 cards just really popped. Now, part of that could be the great card stock, still pretty thick, still pretty sturdy, but also the UV coating. It adds a little bit of gloss, literally and figuratively, to the pictures. And then on top of that, you've got the unfortunate downsides of the UV coating, which is the stickiness and the smell that comes from that. So again, that was the price we paid. We wanted shiny baseball cards back then. Well, now we got them, but they all stick to each other and they tend to tear each other apart. So that's the risk you take with the Upper Deck cards. But let's go back to 1993. You know, it was a great asset to the set. And Upper Deck was moving away from some of the shiny objects that were in the packs and focusing mostly on the card. The most obvious of shiny objects was the sticker. And we had talked about this before with the hologram stickers. They had disappeared by 1993. So, you know, no longer were you just thrilled to get, you know, in various packs, you know, different sets, bubble gum or puzzle pieces or stickers. Nope, it was all about the sets. Give me the inserts. I don't need a Dodgers sticker or whatever. So, you know, the toys were gone. So toys are gone, all business, but still a fun kind of business with 93 Upper Deck. So what were some of the downsides of the Upper Deck set in 1993? Well, as I mentioned, the UV coating sticking to everything, giving a bad smell, gives me headaches, gave me headaches back then, still does now, just that chemical smell that's coming off these cards. So the cards stick together. Sometimes they peel a little bit of the pictures off, and that will certainly ruin the condition of cards. Also, with the Upper Deck sets, one of the downsides is the hologram stickers that were on the cards, which were to prevent the counterfeiting of cards. That was one of the initial things of the 89 set that made it stand out so much. And some of those stickers also over time fleck off a little bit. So sometimes you have some stickers that are peeling off the cards, and that takes the value off there. Also, as I mentioned before, sequencing, unless you got doubles of a good card, you did tend to get some bonus duplicate cards thrown into especially the jumbo packs. And sequencing was always an issue with Upper Deck. But like I said, as long as you got a star card, you didn't mind. If it was common, it seemed to be a total waste. When it comes to rookie cards, you were always guessing with the rookie cards. And we saw this when we were taking a look at the Bowman cards a few months back. You know, with the rookie card craze going absolutely bonkers by 1993, these sets would try to one-up each other, and they would just take these shots in the dark at some of these rookies. So a couple of the rookie cards that I pulled from the set, Joe Witko, who appeared in a whopping three games for the Mets in 1992, was one of the star rookies in this jumbo pack of 93 Upper Deck. And another one was Jesse Hollins, who was a pitcher for the Cubs, had a very brief cup of coffee with the Cubs in the early 1990s. And, you know, his career didn't go anywhere, mostly because of injuries. And sadly, he died way too young back in 2009, drowning while fishing. A real sad story there. I won't get into too much more details because we're also going to look at the story of Steve Olin later on, and that is a depressing story. But, you know, these are just two examples where, you know, the big-name rookie attempts, you take these shots in the dark, and then you hope that they do turn out to be big stars. And then Upper Deck would also milk the rookie routine. And I had mentioned when I had opened up the pack and I found the Pedro Martinez card, I'm like, oh, hey, a Pedro rookie. Totally forgetting that Upper Deck had used Pedro in some kind of rookie or future star fashion, not just once, but twice before. There's a 91 Upper Deck Pedro, there's a 92 Upper Deck Pedro, and here's the 93. And it's a little misleading, but that's just how Upper Deck played the game back then. Of course, Chipper Jones is another great example where, you know, there's a 91 Upper Deck Chipper Jones rookie card. But by 1993, one of the many subsets that we'll talk about had the Peter Gammons, you know, future stars, and one of them was Chipper Jones. So, you know, how many prospect rookie future star cards can you have of one player? But again, that's how it happened. And part of it, I blame Bowman for this too. Bowman would do the same thing by highlighting these guys who were, you know, MVPs of their, you know, double A league. And you would just hope that the player would catch on so that this really early rookie card would be extremely valuable, but you could still move some product by having version 2 or version 3 of a prospect card in later years. So that's not really a bad thing about the Upper Deck set of 1993. It's just one of those things that would drive you crazy. So for every big rookie card that would show up in that set, you had to ask yourself, okay, is this really a rookie card, or are we kind of stretching it here? So you would have in the star rookie column, you would have guys like Mike Piazza. Okay, that's a star rookie card, or a guy who had a pretty decent career like Sterling Hitchcock. But for each of those guys, you would have, you know, again, your Joe Witko or your Jesse Hollins and just guys that never panned out. So you either really hit it with a star rookie card like Javi Lopez. I know that was a big one there. Tim Salmon as well. Like I said, Chipper Jones was in there, JT Snow. But then you had some more that were kind of middle of the pack, to put it nicely. Now, what was the other downside of the 93 Upper Deck set? Well, it wasn't a downside then, but it was a sign of things to come. Insert cards. And when I say insert cards, I mean inserts upon inserts upon inserts upon inserts. So you had a couple of short print cards, SP cards that were featuring a couple of highlights, Robin Yount and George Brett, 3,000 hits from the 1992 season. Then you had the Willie Mays Baseball Heroes Collection. Of course, the Baseball Heroes Collection, a big hit for Upper Deck with Reggie Jackson and Ted Williams before that. So everyone's chasing down not just the subset of Willie Mays cards, but also the autograph cards that were, you know, randomly put into some of these packs here. You also had the Triple Crown Contender card. So there's a subset of 10 cards there. You had the Walter Ayos collection. So these great photography collections here from one of the best photographers of his time. You had the Home Run Heroes, which was featured in these jumbo packs here. You had one in each pack. So we had, you know, Juan Gonzalez was one of those Home Run Heroes cards. You know, anybody who hit over 30 home runs, say, in 1992, there was a card for them. You also had Future Heroes. So here we go again, kind of playing up on the whole prospect thing. You had the fifth anniversary subset as well. Upper Deck, looking back at its first 5 years, of course, you had the fifth anniversary Ken Griffey Jr. card that people went after, some other notable cards that were made at the time. You had the Reggie Jackson Clutch Performers cards. So now here's Reggie Jackson giving his signature of approval, so to speak. Not actually a signature. There was a faux, of course, gold embossed signature that was on there. But, you know, these are the young players Reggie Jackson was endorsing. Then you had On Deck. That was the Peter Gammon subset I was talking about. Oh, here's you know, the wizard of baseball at ESPN, Peter Gammon's, with his selection of guys to look out for. And then you have the then and now. So you're able to get the nostalgia crowd here. Hey, here's a picture of Cal Ripken Jr. from 1983, and here he is in 1993. So you have, count with me, if you include even those single SP cards, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 subsets, ranging in anywhere in size from 1 to 28, distributed anywhere across the board in hobby wax packs, in retail wax packs, hobby and retail jumbo packs. That too was when you started seeing the split of hobby versus retail, and you would get more of these inserts in the hobby pack. So that was supposed to drive you to the card stores as opposed to picking them up at your local grocery store. So this was, in 1993, this was a big deal because, hey, here's that special Peter Gammons card or that Reggie Jackson card or, oh, I got a Willie Mays card. And that, of course, would drive sales. You kept buying it and buying it and buying it, but it also started watering it down here. You had a base set of 840 cards, but then you had these subsets of about 150 or 160 cards, and they were spread out over the two series, and it just started becoming too much. So if you wanted to truly collect the 1993 Upper Deck set, if you wanted to get all of the base cards and all of the insert cards, you had to go on a hunting expedition for 1,000 cards. So you can only imagine how exasperated collectors were at that time. And of course, these are adult collectors. If you were a kid, you couldn't track down all of these cards. You didn't have the money to do it. So that was something, too, that started hurting the hobby as well. It not only priced out children, but also children just could not keep up with the number of cards. Again, 1,000 cards just from one set, never mind all the other sets that were out there and pretty much doing the same thing. So even though Upper Deck was producing an outstanding product in 1993, it was also starting to go overboard with all the bells and whistles. And like I said before, it's kind of a victim of its own success because some of the bells and whistles that Upper Deck introduced in 1989, or in some cases made better than what the competition did in 1989, ultimately would do them in. Because everybody else started doing it, well, Upper Deck had to continue to innovate. And as you started getting more and more and more of these, you know, top shelf inserts here, everybody else tried to outdo it. And that's when you got to the ridiculousness of later years where you had different color refractors, where you had swaths of, you know, a player's jersey or, you know, shavings from a bat being included on cards. And we're talking, you know, some Hall of Fame pieces of memorabilia too, getting chopped up all for the sake of creating a few memorable, hard to find baseball cards. And it was rather unfortunate. So in one way, that's how Upper Deck started coming apart at the seams here. While it was all just part of the business in 1993, it started becoming too much of a business, and it just became too much for anybody to reasonably and affordably collect. Now, as Upper Deck was coming apart at the seams with just how the hobby was turning out, in 1993, it was also getting taken to court by one of its co-founders, of course, relief pitcher Dwayne Bice. The great story of how Dwayne Bice started Upper Deck, or helped Upper Deck get its start, you know, when he went to the Upper Deck baseball card shop outside of Anaheim and was basically the channel to get the co-founders of Upper Deck, get the attention of the Major League Baseball Players Association to have the rights to create a card. Well, Bice got stock as, you know, he was able to introduce everybody to the whole system there. And he made quite a bit of money off of Upper Deck stock. But then Bice realizes, wait a minute, all right, I've made a lot of money off of stock. But if it wasn't for me, these guys would never have an Upper Deck set. It never would have gotten to the Players Association. It never would have gotten produced. Or if it did, it would have been several years and a lot more harder work. He was able to fast track the opportunity there. So he sued Upper Deck, and this all happened in the early 90s. And in a settlement, he got paid reportedly $17 million. So what Upper Deck and Bice decided to do in the court settlement was, rather than pay it out over 4 years, they agreed to pay it out over 6 years. And this was a brilliant stroke by Bice, because with the labor unrest coming around in 1994, while he may not have been collecting as much money as a baseball player, and of course his playing days were pretty much done by this time, he was able to collect a consistent check from Upper Deck, and he was able to spread it out over a longer term of time. So good for Bice, bad for Upper Deck, because that line item in the budget, well, that started eating into the revenues as the hobby is caving in 94, 95, 96, and the income is trickling down to just a fraction of what it used to be. And of course, there's a lot of just unhappiness from baseball fans thanks to the strike in 1994. Bice is collecting this money as legally determined, and Upper Deck can't really start affording it. So Upper Deck really took a punch to the face here, quietly paying off Dwayne Bice over the next several years and having to deal with that double punch of not only the court settlement, but also just the floor falling out from underneath them. And again, everybody else. But it hit Upper Deck really critically hard here, because while other card companies could, you know, just quietly bow out or trim back on some of what they were offering, Upper Deck still had to set the bar and keep putting out these unique sets and some, you know, interesting subsets and kids sets and all this other stuff that they were just cranking out in the mid to late 1990s. So the 93 Upper Deck set is very much, I don't want to say a swan song, because Upper Deck is still doing cards these days. They're not doing baseball. They're an exclusive creator of hockey cards for the National Hockey League, and they've been doing that for a very long time. But Upper Deck, it just kind of, 1993 was kind of the last hurrah. That's the best way I could put it. They set the tone in 1989. They continued to raise the bar. They had to fend off the competition. They had to adjust to the changes in the hobby. 1993 was a great looking card, a great set, but also a sign of things to come. Too many inserts, too many subsets started to price everybody out, and they were hitting the wallet too with the Dwayne Bice settlement. So I look back at 1993 Upper Deck with nostalgia from my teenage days of collecting these and looking at all the awesome cards that they created. But I also look back kind of shaking my head going, yeah, this was pretty much it. It was all downhill for the next few years. And then once the hobby started cleaning itself up, Upper Deck was able to as well. Now, if you're looking to buy 93 Upper Deck, you can get the Series 1 packs and boxes relatively cheap, simply because while you do have some notable names in there, such as Pedro Martinez, or if you want to invest your family's fortunes in Tim Wakefield rookie cards, you can do that. I have seen some pretty decent prices for unopened wax packs of Upper Deck for around $30, not including shipping. I've seen around $30-$35, so essentially a dollar a pack. It's almost like the old days. It's what they sold for. Now, if you're looking at Series 2, that is where the Derek Jeter rookie card is. Those are going for about twice as much. I've seen them around $70-$80, not including shipping. And those Series 2 cards, again, with the Jeter pack, or the Jeter rookie card, excuse me, those packs, again, selling for a premium. And I have seen some PSA pricing. You can, if you get a PSA 10 Jeter, you're paying some bills rather easily, because those do go for upwards of, I've seen some, you know, going well over $1,000. So, you know, you can find some pretty good deals out there for 93 Upper Deck, more Series 1 than Series 2. But just like the Topps cards, we said, you know, it was Derek Jeter that was kind of throwing things off, and especially the Jeter gold card in 93 Topps. Well, just like Topps, Upper Deck also having that as well. By the way, the Jeter card that I said was for a couple $1,000, that is the Jeter card with the gold hologram. So again, one of the splitting hairs here of baseball cards back in the day. So if you have the gold hologram Jeter rookie card from 93 Upper Deck, you can sell that. I've seen it for, you know, a couple $1,000. If you get the quote-unquote basic Derek Jeter rookie card, still, if you get a PSA 10, you can retail it for a couple $100 easily. And even a PSA 8, the average price is around $15-$20. So that's not a bad return, especially if you're buying a box of Series 2 for just $70. You'll probably be able to get at least a couple of those cards in the rotation. Now let's take a look at some of the random pulls from these two jumbo packs. And by pure chance, all four of these cards are pitchers. I did not plan this. It's just how it worked out. Sometimes that's just what happens here. And we're going to tear the Band-Aid off here. We're going to, you know, bring you the sad story for Steve Olin. And I remember, as I'm flipping through these cards, seeing the Steve Olin card. And again, a great action shot of this sidearm submariner just delivering the ball. So it's not, you know, his arm isn't bent under him, but you see it's kind of coming up through the follow-through here. And it's a very unique shot, too, because it is a head-on shot. So this is taken from basically behind home plate, where, you know, most pitcher photographs are taken from the dugout. So you get a profile shot here. This is head-on. And the sad thing about that Steve Olin card is that if you were opening it up at the start of the 1993 season, Steve Olin was dead. And I remember growing up in Tampa, this was a very big story about Steve Olin's death, as well as teammate Tim Cruz. First of all, Tim Cruz was a Tampa native, went to King High School, and owned some property just outside of Winter Haven, where the Indians were spring training. So there was a very, very much a local angle to that really sad story. But also, you know, Steve Olin, because he was so young and had such a promising future, it was just incredibly sad, you know, what happened to both of those gentlemen. So let's do a little story about Steve Olin. Selected in the 16th round in the free agent draft of 1987, after a successful time at the university, or at Portland State University, I should say, he very quickly moved his way up through the Indians farm system. Of course, the Indians did not really have a lot of great pitchers in the late 1980s, so his college seasoning was good enough for the Indians, like I said, very quickly moving up through the major leagues, and was able to make his major league debut July 29th of 1989. He was able to take advantage of Greg Swindell getting injured. So he threw 2 2/3 innings of scoreless relief, was an option for then-manager Doc Edwards, but went back to AAA, which was in Colorado Springs, and very quickly came back into the major leagues. Again, the Indians dealing with injuries and not a very effective pitching staff in 1989. Got his first save on August 9th, 1989, and was heading into the 1990 season as an up-and-coming prospect, and he reminded a lot of people, of course, because of his delivery to the late, great Dan Quisenberry, a longtime reliever with the Kansas City Royals. And people are thinking, okay, this is going to be one of those parts of this rebuild here, and he's going to be a pretty quality relief pitcher here. So he actually made the Indians starting roster in 1990, but after getting roughed up a little bit, got sent down to AAA, working on his pitch selections, and then they called him back up in September of 1990. Now, the Indians would trade Bud Black to Toronto. They needed a starter, a spot starter, because Black was supposed to pitch the following day against the Brewers, so they decided to have Steve Olin make the start. But they also decided to not tell him until 15 minutes before the game. So he very quickly went to the mound, was able to hold his own, and the Indians, who were not a very good team still in 1990, were able to do just enough to help Olin pick up the victory in his only major league start. Now, heading into 1991, he would become more of a product of the minor leagues again, as he was continuing to deal with some control issues, did not throw very well against left-handers, but eventually would find his way back to Cleveland in 1992. Now, his final win, as it would turn out, came in a game September 9th, 1992, at County Stadium in Milwaukee. That was the same game where Robin Yount got his 3,000th hit. It was a single off of Jose Mesa. But despite the Indians trailing 4-3, Indians were able to get a couple of unearned runs to win the game. And then Steve Olin would pick up that victory 5-4, and he would complete the season with an 8-4 record. Now, the Indians going into 1993, I remember there was a lot of hubbub about them. A lot of people were picking them to be kind of that chic team to surprise people. Not that they were good enough to top, say, the Blue Jays or the Tigers or the Brewers, you know, all very competitive teams in the old American League East, but they were going to be good enough to surprise some people. This was not the 100-plus loss team from a couple years ago. All the pieces were starting to come together. They had a lot of great young talent that was coming through the pipeline here, and Olin was going to be part of that bullpen. He was going to be part of that young team. And the Indians, after many, many decades of training at High Corbett Field in Tucson, Arizona, decided to move their spring operations to Florida. And they originally were going to play at a brand new state-of-the-art series of stadiums in Homestead, Florida. Well, that plan got turned aside by Hurricane Andrew in September of 1992 that ripped through Homestead, did significant damage to the new stadium. So the Indians are scrambling. They need to find a place to have spring training, which was starting in just, what, 3-4 months later. So they decide to move into Winter Haven, Florida. Chain of Lakes Park in Winter Haven, longtime spring training site of the Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox had moved south to Sarasota. And the Indians move into this pretty old system of parks and stadiums at Chain of Lakes Park. Now, Chain of Lakes Park was built in the mid-60s, High Corbett Field. The Indians have been playing there since the 40s, so this was kind of an upgrade, I guess. But at least it was a spring training home. They needed something after the hurricane. The Red Sox had vacated Winter Haven, and of course, Winter Haven opened arms to the Indians, and they moved on in. So, tragically, what should have been a fresh start, a new opportunity for this young and upcoming team, would change on March 22nd, 1993. The Indians had an off day, and Tim Cruz, who had some property off of Little Lake Nellie nearby Winter Haven, had invited the whole team to come out and just have like a big barbecue and picnic over at his house. But the only people who decided to go from the team were Olin, Bob Ojeda, and strength coach Fernando Montes. Now, as the story is told, and this is told through the Society of American Baseball Research group here, Joseph Wancho with the story, as the story goes, Olin and his family were going out there. So it was Olin and his wife, Patty, and their just recently turned 3-year-old daughter, Alexa. And they're driving from Winter Haven to this farm, which I believe was in Davenport, which is On a map, it's close to Winter Haven, but there's a lot of country roads in this area. It's very easy to get lost. A lot of rural parts here in this part of Florida. So the Olins are actually having trouble trying to find this ranch. They're getting lost. And Patty was getting fed up and basically said, why don't we just turn around and go home? But Steve really, really, really wanted to go out to the farm. So they finally get out there. And eventually, after some drinks are consumed and some good times are had, Cruz says, hey, let's go in the boat and go cruising around the lake. So Cruz, Ojeda, and Olin climb into an 18-foot bass boat. They're circling around the lake, and there was a neighbor's dock which extended more than 50 yards into the water. Now, as Cruz was accelerating, the boat, of course, the bow is kind of raising up a little bit. You've seen this, especially as it's hitting the crest in the water. And the bow is going up and up and up, and it was obscuring the view of the dock. So here comes, in 3 or 4 feet of water, this boat racing towards the dock. Cruz doesn't see it and just plows right into the dock. Olin was killed instantly. Cruz was airlifted to a hospital. He would die the next day. Bob Ojeda, who fortunately for him was kind of slouched in his seat in the boat, sustained some major injuries, but he was able to survive. He would actually pitch for the Indians later on that season. But it was just a tragic, tragic story, and especially because the Olin family was there. One of the reasons why Steve Olin was racing out to go to the farm here and just determined to get out there was because he had promised his daughter a horseback ride. And it's just so many what-ifs. You know, what if Hurricane Andrew didn't tear up the ballpark in Homestead? You know, what if Steve Olin just went, okay, fine, we'll go home? You know, what if he just didn't get in the boat? And more importantly, sadly, what if Tim Cruz's blood alcohol level was not above the legal limit? And that was, unfortunately, what was determined afterwards, his blood alcohol content was, I believe, at 0.14, which is about 3 times the amount that you can legally have in piloting a boat, and almost twice the amount in driving a car in the state of Florida. So just incredibly sad, the circumstances around it. And like I said, I remember that story fresh because it was close by. My parents eventually moved to Winter Haven. And, I lived probably about an hour outside of Winter Haven, so I was quite familiar with where, you know, this accident happened. But also, again, the Tim Cruz tie-in to Tampa, it was an extremely sad story and really just cast a dark cloud over the Indian season in 1993. The Indians opening up in Cleveland in April of 1993, giving the jerseys of the players, Olin and Cruz, to their widows. Very sad moment there. And what should have been just this really bright and vibrant and up-and-coming season for the Indians was really just dampened by the whole thing. Now, the good news, the silver lining here, if you will, by 1995, that young up-and-coming Indians team is starting to gel into a contender. The Indians decide to sign veteran and future Hall of Famer Dave Winfield to the table here. And Winfield had worn number 31 for his entire career. Well, that was Steve Olin's number. So before the Indians issued the number, they called Patty Olin as a courtesy, and she gave it her blessing. So that was an inspiration to Dave Winfield, the old man Dave Winfield, and the Indians clinching a playoff berth for the first time in 41 years on September 8th, 1995. And during the celebration, Mike Hargrove, then the manager of the Indians, requested that the song The Dance by Garth Brooks be played over the public address system. That was apparently the favorite song or a favorite song of Steve Olin. So even though they didn't announce that they were doing this, even though a lot of people in the room at the time probably didn't know the significance, those that did know brought to their knees in sadness and just remembering Cruz and Olin. So it was just an incredibly sad story here. And I just remember looking through these cards and kind of pausing at Steve Olin, and you shake your head. It's been 27 years, 27 years, but it's still fresh in my mind. Cause it was kind of a literal close to home hit here, you know, with the cruise tie into the Tampa area and, you know, this happening not that far from where I was living at the time. So I remember it well. It was a very, very tragic story. Now let's go from tragic to tragic comedy. Let's go to something fun. All right. We're all saddened by the deaths of Steve Olin and Tim Cruz. Let's go to something fun here. Roger McDowell was another card that we pulled out here. And McDowell is the jokester. And you could see it on this 93 Upper Deck card as he is wearing a T-shirt that says La Sorda U. And you have to remember, too, the Dodgers were going through a real funk in 1992. And I think Tom Lasorda's job was on the line back then. You know, he had taken over for Walter Alston, what, 15, 16 years before? Yeah, won a couple World Series, but some people were wondering, is he too old for the job now? So a little bit of levity during an otherwise controversial year. And that's what all Roger McDowell was about. A native of Cincinnati, graduating from Colerain High School in 1979, would go to Bowling Green State University, where fellow teammate Oral Hershiser would get drafted by the Dodgers. Meanwhile, McDowell, after his time at Bowling Green, would get drafted by the New York Mets, a third-round selection in 1982. Dealing with a lot of injury issues on his climb through the minor leagues, he was able to develop a sinker ball, which would turn out to be his key pitch in his arsenal. And after throwing some games in the Instructional League in 1985, Davey Johnson was impressed by what he could do, invited him to spring training, and he was able to make the major league roster in 1985. He was able to take over from the veteran Doug Sisk, who was dealing with some injury problems as well. And McDowell would make his major league debut April 11th, 1985, pitching a hitless, scoreless top of the 11th against the St. Louis Cardinals. And the Mets would score in the bottom of the inning to get the win. So McDowell earning his first major league win in his first major league appearance, which was pretty impressive. The sinker ball would be a key part of his arsenal in his rookie season in 1985, and he would be a key cog in the Mets World Series championship team in 1986, as he played not only a major role in the regular season, but in the postseason, was part of a very effective and often overlooked bullpen that helped the team move through that marathon National League Championship Series with Houston, and then eventually the seven-game series against the Red Sox. In fact, McDowell is the winner of record in Game 7 of the 86 series. He was the beneficiary of the Mets' three-run rally in the seventh inning, and he would get the win even though he gave up a couple of those runs back in an eighth-inning rally by the Red Sox. Now, in 1987, he was dealing with some injury issues, was able to come back later on in the season. Also had a pretty successful 1988 season, but while he was rather heroic in 1986, gave up some surprising hits, including a surprising home run off the bat of Kirk Gibson in the NLCS. Mets, of course, bowing out to the Dodgers. Dodgers would eventually go on to win the World Series that year. Now, in 1989, the Mets looking to shake things up after a bad start, with Trey McDowell, also Lenny Dykstra, and minor league reliever Tom Edens to Philadelphia for Juan Samuel. That was a pretty lopsided trade there. Samuel's career was well on the outside in going out. And in fact, he wouldn't come back to the Mets in 1990. And of course, the Phillies looked pretty good with that deal there, as McDowell was able to provide a little bit of veteran presence in the bullpen for a rebuilding Phillies team. But also Dykstra, of course, nails, would become a star in Philadelphia and would be a key part to the 1993 National League pennant team in Philadelphia. Now, McDowell would not be part of that team, even though he signed a three-year contract with the Phillies in 1990, as he would lose the closer role to the newly acquired Mitch Williams. Now, he would also play an important part in the 1993 team, but not as well-liked by Phillies fans as Lenny Dykstra was. So in 1991, the Phillies decided to send McDowell to the Dodgers for outfielder Rolio Castillo and reliever Mike Harkey. And McDowell would pitch with the Dodgers through 1994. Would continue bouncing around later on in his career, signing with Texas in 1995, Baltimore in 1996, the White Sox in 1997, and he tried to revive his career heading into the 1998 season with the White Sox, but wasn't able to do that. Now, after his playing career, he got into coaching and was a longtime pitching coach for the Atlanta Braves, succeeded Leo Mazzoni when Mazzoni went to Baltimore. That is where McDowell went. And McDowell was there for, I believe, 11 seasons. So he was there for quite a lengthy amount of time. And then after his time in Atlanta, ironically, was the pitching coach in Baltimore starting in the 2017 season. Now, McDowell was a king of pranks. He was the ultimate prankster, had kind of this bad boy persona as well. He would star in the MTV Rock and Jock softball games. Remember that? He and Keith Hernandez also appearing in the legendary Seinfeld episode, The Boyfriend, where there's all the conspiracies around the Kennedy assassination. And he's still collecting royalty checks on that episode, by the way. Not huge money, but he's still collecting it. And here's a list of some of the other notable pranks that McDowell pulled off. He was a legendary hot foot creator, very seldom caught in the act. He would be able to attach some matches to the shoes of several teammates or coaches and light fire to them. And that, of course, is the oldest trick in the book there, right? He also, prior to an honoring of Rusty Staub in 1986, McDowell was able to purchase a whole bunch of red wigs, so the whole team came out with red hair, just like Staub had. He also appeared on the field in 1987, wearing his uniform upside down, pants stretched over his head, shoes on his hand. He also, as Major League Baseball was cracking down on pitchers like Joe Niekro doctoring the ball, he appeared in the bullpen with a tool belt with sandpaper, a file, chisel, lubricant, you name it. And also, he once got the attention of some fans at Dodger Stadium who were sitting near the bullpen. And once he got a few people to kind of peek into the bullpen, he would throw open the door to where an unsuspecting Jesse Orosco was sitting on the can and then suddenly had a live audience. And my favorite, when he was with the Phillies, Tommy Green threw a no-hitter. And Tommy Green was one of the least likely of pitchers to throw a no-hitter in baseball history. Well, he throws a no-hitter against the Expos in 1991, and McDowell called the Phillies clubhouse and pretended to be Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, who was then the PM of Canada. And Green had this very lengthy conversation with who he thought was the Prime Minister of Canada, and it was actually Roger McDowell. So I thought that was pretty clever. So that's a nice little yin and yang there after the Steve Olin tragedy, looking back at Roger McDowell and some of the wackiness and goofiness that he had. Now, here's another pitcher here who wasn't necessarily as wacky or as goofy, but he just had one of those names where if you were a teenager and you were collecting baseball cards, you loved pulling this guy's card. No, he wasn't Pete LeCocq. No, he wasn't Rusty Kuntz. He was Timothy Wayne Belcher. Go ahead, sum up that gas that's in your belly. Just let it out. You know you want to. Yes, Tim Belcher, 14 years in the major leagues, 1987 through 2000. Not without controversy, however. He would play his high school baseball at Highland High School in Mount Vernon, Ohio, and eventually went on to Mount Vernon Nazarene College. And he was the first overall draft pick in the 1983 draft by the Minnesota Twins, but he refused to sign. Twins might regret that had they took another notable pitcher first overall at that time. Gentleman by the name of Roger Clemens. He went, I think, 19th to the Red Sox. Oops. So free of the Minnesota Twins, Tim Belcher would continue to play college ball and eventually was signed in the supplemental draft by the Yankees and then picked up by the Oakland Athletics in the compensation pool. And after he worked his way through the A's system, he was traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers September of 1987. He was the ubiquitous player to be named later in the Rick Honeycutt transaction. Now, this is an important moment in baseball card history, because had Rick Honeycutt not been dealt from the Dodgers to the A's, we would not have the legendary, awful, airbrushing, puffy hat look for the 88 Topps Rick Honeycutt card that came out. So quite the contribution here that Tim Belcher made, whether he knew it or not. Now, he would make his major league debut 3 days later, and he was part of the 88 Dodgers team that won the World Series and also defeated the Mets and Roger McDowell, that National League Championship Series. In 1989, he had 10 complete games, tied with, you guessed it, that other 1983 draft product, Roger Clemens. Pretty interesting there. Also had the Major League Baseball lead in total shutouts with 8. Had top 10 finishes in wins in ERA. And his 1989 shutout total has not since been equal in Major League Baseball. How about that? You know, Tim Belcher, you used to just make fun of his name. But here's a guy that was just as dominant as Oral Hershiser or, you know, some of the other big names in the game at that time. 8 shutouts in 1989 and 10 complete games. Now, as Tim Belcher would continue his time with the Dodgers, it would end after the 1991 season. He was part of that big Eric Davis trade, as Belcher would go to the Reds along with John Wetland for Davis and Kip Gross. He would pitch with the Reds in 1992 and midway through the 93 season. So he's pictured here in the Cincinnati uniform. But at the trade deadline, 1993, moved to the Chicago White Sox for Jeff Pierce and Johnny Ruffin. He would be the winner of Game 4 of the American League Championship Series against Toronto that year. Released after the 1993 season, would sign as a free agent with Detroit in 1994, but had a disastrous year as he was just rung up for 15 losses in a strike-shortened season. So he actually benefited from the shortened 1994 season. He could have ended up with 20 losses the way the Tigers were going. He would become a free agent once again, returns to Cincinnati in 1995, and again is traded by Cincinnati. He would, however, again get traded to a contender as he was sent to Seattle for Roger Salkeld after the Mariners' surprise playoff run in 1995, granted free agency once again, and then would bounce around Kansas City in 1996 for a couple of seasons, signs with the Anaheim Angels in 1998, and that is where he would wrap up his big league career after the 2000 season. Now, like I said, Tim Belcher, not without some controversy or some notable notes in his career. It should be noted, he is the pitcher of record who gave up the first hit to Derek Jeter. Happened in May 30th, 1995. Also, after Game 2 of the 1995 American League Division Series, he assaulted a cameraman in the locker room. You may recall it was Belcher who gave up the game-winning home run to Jim Leyritz. So taking out his aggression on the cameraman there. And then in 1999, he was involved in an on-field brawl at Dodger Stadium. This was an interleague series between the Dodgers and the Angels. And at the time, Belcher was with the Angels. He got into a pretty big fight with Chan Ho Park. Park had claimed that Belcher tagged him too hard on a recent play. And Belcher remarked with racist comments, causing Park to kick him. So naturally, where does racist comments Tim Belcher end up as a coach later? The Indians, pitching coach for Cleveland back in 2010. And he would eventually move up to a special assistant to baseball operations later on. And this was, I think, 2015. So there's the Tim Belcher story. And now one last great name. And as I mentioned in the video, this is one of those Harry Carey names, as he is pictured here with the Chicago Cubs. It would be his last season with the Chicago Cubs. We're talking about Chuck McElroy, the Southpaw Charles McElroy from Port Arthur, Texas, warming up on the bullpen today. So let's take a look at Chuck McElroy. This is one of those guys who didn't necessarily do anything great, but was just good enough to have a very lengthy career, 13 years in the big leagues. Now, I don't want to say this guy was crap, because Chuck McElroy wasn't. He was a very effective lefty, but kind of went the Dan Plesac route, didn't he? Boy, he was just able to just milk his career for a very long time. Terry Mulholland, another one. Same kind of situation here. But unlike Mulholland, who, you know, had some stints as a starter. And, you know, McElroy started a few games too late in his career. But, you know, Chuck McElroy is kind of from the Dave Burba school of pitching, where he didn't do anything spectacular, but he was always in demand. So let's take a look at Chuck McElroy real quickly here. An eighth round selection by the Phillies in the 1986 draft, would move up through their minor league system, make his major league debut in 1989. In fact, he would appear in 11 games with the Phillies that year. Had a pretty good look there, too. A 1.74 earned run average. Pretty solid control as well. Didn't quite work out so well in 1990. Appearing in 16 games, had a ballooning earned run average of 7.71. So he was spending a little more time in the minor leagues. But then would become a full-time major leaguer in 1991. Remember what I was saying during the Roger McDowell conversation, how McDowell lost his spot as the closer for the Phillies to Mitch Williams? Well, it was actually Chuck McElroy who was traded for Mitch Williams. He and Bob Scanlon go into the Cubs for Wild Thing Mitch Williams, April of 1991. So he becomes a regular part of the Cubs bullpen in the 1991 season, appearing in 71 games. And, had a few saves as well. So he was able to come in as a closer a few times. And the Chuck McElroy that the Phillies saw certainly came around in 1991 in those 71 games with a 1.95 earned run average. In fact, that would be his best full season earned run average and a 6-2 record to boot. And also the most strikeouts that he had in a season, 92 strikeouts to 57 walks here. So he had, you know, some control, not great, more strikeouts than walks, but again, not great, but good enough to where teams wanted him. And let's follow the bouncing ball here, the Chuck McElroy tour, if you will. So he got traded by the Cubs to the Reds in December 1993 for Mike Anderson, Derry Cox, and Larry Lubbers. The Reds then have him on the team 1994 and 95. Of course, the Reds getting to a playoff berth in 1995. Traded by Cincinnati to the Angels for Hall of Famer Lee Smith in May of 1996. So he's with the Angels in the latter part of 1996, then traded May of 1997 with Jorge Fabregas to the White Sox for Chad Kruder and Tony Phillips. Now, he was drafted by the Arizona Diamondbacks in the expansion draft in 1997, then traded by the Diamondbacks for Harvey Pulliam. So he's with the Rockies, of course, a team that's contending at that time. He's later traded in 1999 along with Darrell Hamilton to the Mets for minor leaguer Tom Johnson, Rigo Beltran, and Brian McCray. So he's part of that 99 Mets team that makes a pretty lengthy playoff run. But then he gets traded by the Mets to the Baltimore Orioles for fan favorite Jesse Orosco after the 1999 season. The Orioles are kind of on the downturn at this time, however, but McElroy would continue to play with the Orioles through midway through the 2001 season. He was released by the Baltimore Orioles in July. A few days later, picked up by the San Diego Padres. Again, one of those teams kind of sort of contending back then, and eventually was granted free agency, and that was the end of his career. Now, his son, C.J. McElroy, was a third-round draft selection of the St. Louis Cardinals in 2011. So the McElroy family continuing shortly after Dad's retirement to have some influence in Major League Baseball. So again, Chuck McElroy, just one of those guys, like I said, like Dave Burba, you kind of remember him, but you don't remember what he did. But he was just a good enough left-handed option out of the bullpen, a guy that could throw to one or two batters when you needed him. And that is why he was able to sustain a very lengthy career and why he was moved so often, and in many of the cases, moving from a pretender to a contender year after year. Well, no things pretending with 93 Upper Deck, definitely a contender. And like I said, kind of like just that apex of success. This was the best Upper Deck was going to get in the early days of Upper Deck before it became a victim to its own success, not only within the hobby, because everybody was catching up and everybody was doing all of these insert cards and all this other nonsense at the time, but also because of the lawsuits. The Dwayne Bice lawsuit, it started cutting into their bottom line. And 1993 is just that last hurrah. The we're Upper Deck, you know, you could just see with the quality of the cards and how even despite the competition and the changes, they were still commanding how things were being done with baseball cards then. But then things would start pulling apart both in the accounting ledger and also just in the hobby as well, as everybody had to kind of recollect what was going on in the mid to late 90s and kind of, you know, clean up the mess that they had made. And Upper Deck, part of the creator of that mess, but also one of the victims of it as well. But 1993 Upper Deck, great looking set. Easy to get, especially Series 1 over Series 2, but even if you're willing to pay the extra dollars for Series 2 packs, you might land one of those Derek Jeter rookie cards that you can turn around for a quick fortune. You might also land one of the many insert cards, depending whether you're getting wax or jumbo, retail or hobby, depending what you're finding out there. But still, a fun set to collect. A neat junk wax era set that won't set you back too much. If you're trying to collect the whole thing, even the 840 base cards, it's going to take a lot of time. It's a rather laborious effort. But I think you'll be flooded with great memories of some of the cards from the 93 Upper Deck set. So check it out if you get a chance. And maybe if you're cruising eBay or you're searching through the dollar a pack box at your local card store or card show, you will probably see it and go, oh yes, and you'll buy it. Not because there's anything of great value other than that Jeter card in there, but just for the fun memory of that last outstanding premium base set card that Upper Deck was producing before things just fell apart. Well, this podcast, I think, has fallen apart. It's time to wrap things up here. Again, we'll be coming your way 2 weeks from today. That is Friday, August the 28th. What is our topic? I don't know. But I told you some of the upcoming show topics. 61 Tops. Tops Kmart set, 86 Donruss, 87 Donruss pop-ups, and Tops chewing gum wrappers, and also the 93 minor league cards for the classic best group. Maybe we'll leave it up to a vote. That might be something we do at Wax and Gum Stains. And also, if you would like to make a donation, again, cardboard donations, always appreciated. Just please let me know what you would like to donate before you send it to me. MattSalmonSays@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to make a cash donation, paypal.me/waxecstatic. We appreciate all donations. It's helped us do some shopping here. It's helped us keep the program on the air. And helps us keep it free for the greater mass of listeners as well. We certainly appreciate all contributions. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Wash your hands, wear your mask, practice social distancing. Join us for the next Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you then.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.